a psychologist, an author, and a veteran broadcaster. But most importantly, he's a dad. Welcome to Dr. Bill Meyer Live on the Faith Radio Network. Stay tuned for a faith and culture connection, a biblical perspective on current events, and practical family advice with psychologist Dr. Bill Meyer. You can join the conversation by calling 877-93-FAITH. That's 877-933-2484. Now, let's join Bill Meyer live.
Well, thank you, and Morgan Wood, we appreciate so much that introduction. Welcome to the Faith Radio Network, and we have a great program lined up for you today. If you have teenagers who are getting set to go off to college, you know, moms and dads, there are some things you need to know about today's college environment that you might not be aware of, whether or not your child is heading off to a Christian college or a secular school, a state university or a private college. And we're going to be talking to an expert who has written a great new book called Preparing Your Teens for College. He's actually a college professor himself, and he has some great insights on this particular topic. So stick with us. And if you know somebody who has, let's say, a junior or senior in high school who is, their child is getting ready to go off to college or starting to apply to some different schools, encourage them to tune in for the next 45 minutes or so, because they're going to get some information that will really be helpful to them as they make these major decisions. And also some ways to provide their kids with some guidance that they will so desperately need, especially if they head off to a secular school, to a state university. Because as you probably know, moms and dads, unfortunately, that is not a very positive environment for Christian young people today, both philosophically and morally. And we will dive into that topic with our guest, Alex Chediak, in just a few minutes here on the Faith Radio Network. First of all, I found a few faith-related stories I thought would interest you. Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker is in hot water with atheists after tweeting a Bible verse. I don't know if you heard about this. Governor Walker recently tweeted Philippians 4:13, that wonderful verse which says, "I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me." He said the verse was part of a devotional that he had read that morning, and he wanted to share it. Well, the atheist group Freedom From Religion Foundation is demanding that Governor Walker remove that post from Twitter and Facebook. They say the governor is using his position to promote Christianity. And how did Governor Walker respond? Well, he says he has no plans to take down that Bible verse. That's called freedom of speech. Thank you very much, Freedom From Religion Foundation. Here's another interesting story. It's kind of on a related topic. The president of Ball State University is in Indiana, is planning to meet with four Indiana legislators over a freedom of religion issue. Here's what's happening. The lawmakers are questioning her decision to prohibit the teaching of intelligent design in a science course at Ball State. The president of the school, Joanne Gora, has invited these four lawmakers to the Muncie campus after they wrote to her questioning whether or not the school had violated the religious and academic freedoms of the science professor who was involved in this. In fact, these four lawmakers from Indiana say they might even seek some kind of legislative action over the treatment of this professor, a physics professor. He was accused of teaching creationism. Well, he did nothing of the sort. He taught intelligent design theory as an alternative to Darwinism, to unguided evolution. And so we'll see how this thing shakes out. But isn't it great that we have some conservative legislators in Indiana who are standing up for religious freedom in that state? And here's an encouraging story. Mission Aviation Fellowship, wonderful organization, MAF, they have a brand new airplane that is going to help them spread the gospel to isolated people groups in Southeast Asia. MAF's newest aircraft is a Quest Kodiak, which I understand is a really cool airplane. It's going to be based in remote Indonesia. John Boyd of MAF says this: "This remarkable airplane will be used to deliver food, medicine, building materials, and Bibles. It will transport medical teams, missionaries, and relief workers. It will carry children to school and the sick to the hospital. Wow. You know, I would encourage you to pray for the folks at Mission Aviation Fellowship. Pray for the pilots, the ground crews, those folks who are based here in the U.S. and all of those different bases overseas where they have aircraft. Pray that God will protect them, because often they're in very dangerous, difficult situations, both, you know, as far as the flying that they do and also some of the political things that they have to deal with. And pray that they will be able to share God's love with those who don't know him yet, because, again, they're in some very remote places in the world. I have had a chance to go to Indonesia several years ago on a short-term missions trip and visited some of the different islands, and you talk about remote. I met people who lived in houses on stilts and had no electricity, no running water. By the way, the reason they were in their houses on stilts is so the wild animals don't come and eat them at night, and the snakes don't come into their beds, which, you know, that's never pleasant when you're, you know, in the middle of the night and the snake crawls in with you. So, but they would plow their fields with oxen pulling plows behind them. No tractors. These were the classic kind of National Geographic scenes you see of the terraced rice fields up on the hills of, we were on a couple different islands in Indonesia, and fascinating experience. And that's one of the places where Mission Aviation Fellowship is doing their wonderful work. So again, please keep them in your prayers. Well, it's 10 minutes past the hour. I'm Bill Meyer. This is the Faith Radio Network. And coming up next, we're going to be talking to Dr. Alex Chediak. He is a professor at California Baptist University, has written a great new book for parents and students, Preparing Your Teens for College. You got a high school student, maybe a junior or senior getting ready to head off. You got to stick around for this interview here on the Faith Radio Network.
The mother of a 3-year-old boy told me the other day about taking her son to nursery school for the first time. Another mother was also arriving with her twin girls. As they walked into the center, the director got very excited about the beauty of the little girls. "Oh my," she said, "your girls are just gorgeous. Look at that hair. I just can't believe how cute they are." Well, the first mother said that there were about 15 other children standing around the room watching and listening to their teacher. And you can believe they learned something that day about the values of the culture. A bright preschooler is fully capable of thinking, no one ever says anything like that to me. What's different about my hair? It must be important to be pretty. Am I pretty? Indeed, research has demonstrated that by 3 years of age, those who are physically attractive already enjoy greater popularity among their peers. Those youngsters who are not admired by their peers are often troubled by that fact from very early in life. Cruel voices whisper their evil messages in their childish ears. The other children don't like you. "See, I told you you'd fail. You're different. You're foolish. They hate you. You're worthless." This is the prelude to a stormy adolescence in many cases, and it's produced by a culture that awards great value to some human beings and unabashedly withholds it from others.
You can find more Family Talk with Dr. James Dobson at myfamilytalk.com.
It's Dr. Bill Meyer live on Faith Radio. Get ready to join the conversation. Now let's join Dr. Bill Meyer live.
And welcome back. It is so great to have you with us on this Saturday here on the Faith Radio Network. You can find our entire weekend schedule at myfaithradio.com, myfaithradio.com. You can also send me a quick note if you've got a question regarding any of our topics here. We have a contact link on my page. Just look for the weekend schedule, look for my page, and shoot me a quick note. And, of course, you can call us, 877-93-FAITH, anytime during the program. And if you call during this hour and give us your contact information, your name, address, phone number, email address, you know what we'll do? We'll put you into a drawing for a book written by this hour's guest. The book is called Preparing Your Teens for College. And as I mentioned, if you have a junior or senior in high school at home, great book, which will help you tremendously. Or if you know somebody whose child is about to get ready for the college experience, maybe your youth pastor, it could be just a wonderful resource for you. The author of the book is Alex Chediak. He is a speaker and a professor of engineering and physics at California Baptist University. Alex is the author of the best-selling book Thriving at College, in addition to the one we just mentioned. He's published numerous articles in Christian College Guide and Boundless, which is an online magazine produced by Focus on the Family for young adult Christians. I used to work at Focus on the Family, as you may know, and have a lot of good friends that work in the Boundless area. Alex has a PhD in engineering from the University of California, Berkeley. He and his wife, Marnie, and their three children live in Riverside, California, which is where Cal Baptist is located. And Alex, welcome to Faith Radio.
Thanks for having me.
It is a real blessing. This is a very important topic. I talk to parents every day who are shaking in their boots for two reasons. One, they're thinking about the incredible costs associated with college these days. And then those that are Christian parents are very concerned about some of the moral and philosophical challenges that their young people will be facing in college. And you address both of those things in this book. How long have you been teaching at Cal Baptist, Alex?
7 years.
And it's a wonderful school. I've been on your campus. You still have a great baseball team?
We do. Thank you. Yes. Yeah.
One of the best, I understand. Alex, what got you inspired to help parents navigate these issues with young people as they head off to college?
So a few years ago, I wrote a book called Thriving at College, which was for the student graduating high school and headed off. And I wanted to give them kind of a roadmap on how do you make the most of the college experience? How do you really make it a launching pad into all that goes with responsible Christian adulthood? And after I wrote that, I was speaking on radio stations and conferences and different places, and I found parents asking me, hey, why don't you help us to get our teens ready for college? So I said, okay, that makes sense. Now I started to write a book for them, so I wanted to help them kind of get them ready before they went to college. I was also noticing at college campus that the students who were most prepared by their parents, the students whose parents were most active in getting them ready for college, were actually the ones who were hitting the ground well-prepared from day one. And so they actually had a huge advantage over those who were less well-prepared by their parents. And so it wasn't really so much SAT score or high school grades as it was character and maturity and the things that the parents had worked into their children that had made a big difference. And so then as I was observing all that and speaking about thriving at college, I began to write a book for parents over the last couple of years.
Well, we are so glad you did. Where do you think parents fall down on the job in equipping their kids? I mean, yeah, maybe they help them with their college applications, help them to study up, get a good SAT score, help them move into the dorm and, you know, navigate the campus the first day or so. But it sounds like there are some areas that parents aren't even thinking about.
Yeah, I would say a couple areas. The heart and the character. What I mean by that is the habits that a teen has in terms of responsibility, maturity, independence, taking initiative for their own life. That's not as developed as I think could be. Because when they get to college, really they're not going to have somebody watching over them, telling them when to do this or that. They're going to have an internal moral compass that says, these are my priorities. These are my values. I'm going to live out of those values and priorities. And the other issue would be the faith issue. Sometimes our teens can borrow the faith of their parents and not really make it their own. And so we have to encourage them to ask questions and to interact with them in the high school years to say, look, is this really what you believe for yourself? Or are you just saying this because we taught it to you? Have you thought about it for yourself? Because when you get to college, people will challenge you as to what you think for yourself.
Now,
you're
at a Christian college where, of course, faith is supported, but I'm sure you've talked to many students and parents that have gone off to secular schools like UC Berkeley, UCLA, USC, perhaps here in the upper Midwest, someone that's gone off to the University of Minnesota and had a tragic experience. Maybe their kids have fallen away from the faith or they've dropped out their first year. Are there any themes that you find that are common among those kids that have really struggled?
Yeah, I think that one of the common themes is that they didn't have an environment at home or at their youth group where they weren't allowed to ask questions or weren't encouraged to ask questions. They kind of conformed externally because they had supportive circumstances that kept them living a certain lifestyle and saying they believed certain things, but they never really had a chance to show it themselves. And so I think early in life, that's really important to tell our kids, okay, this is what Christianity believes. We're going to fellowship on Sunday morning at church. We're going to learn about the Bible. This is what Christianity teaches. This is what you should believe. And you kind of feed them scripture memory, maybe catechism, statement of faith. But then as they get older, is it time to ask them in dialogue and say, okay, now you are at a stage intellectually where you should be able to interact with this and say it in your own words what you believe about the exclusivity of Christ, about the Bible, about whether Jesus is the only way to God, and really wrestle with these questions that you're going to have people ask you about when you get to college. And so as we get them ready to think through those things for themselves, they're not hearing it for the first time when they're going away at college. I think those students end up coming out with a more vibrant faith, even if they seem at time at high school to be wrestling and to be struggling and to be asking questions. Those are the growing pains whereby a student owns the faith for themselves, and they have to go through that to make it their own and not just what their parents say.
Mm. Now, I've seen some statistics that as many as 75% of Christian young people, evangelical Christian young people, who go off to a secular college, either a state university or a secular private school, leave the faith, at least leave the church, by the time they graduate from college. I've also heard that stat may be somewhat exaggerated. Have you seen any solid numbers? What is your opinion on that?
Yeah, the number I've seen is about the same as what you've seen. But what I've read about that is that it's leaving for a season, maybe up to a year, and then return. And then about two-thirds of those actually come back later in life, maybe after college or even during college. So I don't think it's quite as high in terms of long-term leaving, permanent leaving. A lot of it is just maybe they're in transition, maybe they move to a new town, and it takes them a little while to find a new church home at college, but then they return at some point. I'm not denying that it's not an issue. We definitely have too many churched kids that abandon the faith or backslide for a season in college, but I don't think it's 75% being a permanent departure.
Mm-hmm. Now, Fuller Seminary, the youth, youth development or whatever they call it, department at Fuller, which is not that far from you, they have this new research on sticky faith and the things that actually help a young person stay connected to their Christian faith in college. And one of the things that they have come up with, it seems to be really, if you look at all the different factors, one of the most important factors is having other adults in their life while they're in high school, other adults perhaps in their church, in their extended family, who will speak truth to them, who will dialogue with them on these issues, so that it's not just mom and dad. Has that been your experience as well?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think as wonderful as a teen's relationship with their parents can be, I think a teen wants to see it validated in more adults. The more connecting points a teen has faith-wise to mentors and adults who are in their life, investing in their life, the better they're going to be, the more likely they are to stay in the faith. I know some parents of students at Cal Baptist who have encouraged their teens to find a mentor of the same gender, like a man for a boy and woman for a girl, who would go out to them for lunch once a month or so the last couple of years of high school. And then when they go home on breaks, that mentor connects with them and says, "How are you doing? How is college going?" And I think that's so important for a teen to see, you know what, this Christian faith is being lived out, not just in my parents, but in all these other adults. And I'm joining into a community of faith. There is not just our family. This is something big and strong and that is historically rooted. And it can be lived out. It can be practical. Like, there are Christian ways of living and doing college that cause me to flourish, because God knows how I'm made, and God knows I'm made for purity and for having good integrity in my life and working and being disciplined. This is part of how God's made me to thrive. And worshiping God on Sunday morning is contributing to connecting me, keeping me growing in my faith walk and applying that faith walk Monday through Friday. Mm-hmm. So I think that's very important to have more adults in their life. And then sometimes they're more comfortable asking a question to someone else besides their mom and dad. And that's okay. I think sometimes other parents are gifted, or other men and women are gifted in ways that we as parents might not be gifted. And so then it can be a collaborative thing with multiple adults bringing our kids into the faith life of being an adult.
Isn't it interesting how our teenagers, let's say as a sophomore, junior, senior in high school, they may be going through a time of rebellion, really separating from mom and dad, and mom and dad can have a friend who has exactly the same values, and their child will listen to that friend when they won't listen to their own mother or father.
Right, yeah, it is remarkable. And I think part of it is something, I know for me as when I was a teen, some of it was I didn't want my parents to have the satisfaction of knowing that I was listening to what they were saying. I remember being 15 years old, right, and you'd hear things from your mom and dad, and you wouldn't want them to know that you did it because they said it. You knew they were right, but you kind of didn't want them to have the pleasure of being right in that environment. Or you wanted to figure it out for yourself so that you could feel like, yeah, this was what I discovered. And so hearing it from multiple people, from some other parent, was easier to swallow and then to kind of own it myself and say, yeah, mom and dad, that's what I'm going to do because I want to do it. I'm doing it because I think it's right, not just because you're telling me it's right.
You know, this is such an important issue, Alex, and I'm so glad you brought it up. And I want to challenge any parents who are listening who have kids in junior high or high school. If you don't have other adults that are, speaking blessing, speaking truth into your kids' lives, whether that's, again, aunt, uncle, grandma, grandpa, somebody from the church, youth leader, you need to be developing those now. Because when that child goes away from home, goes off to college, those relationships are going to be so key. And I would challenge adults who are in a church that, let's say maybe we have people listening right now whose kids are grown, and there are teenagers in their congregation. You know, why not take an interest in a young person and come alongside them, with their parents' permission, of course, and help that mom and dad to, strengthen that child's faith, to help to equip them, prepare them for what they're going to face on their college journey. I think a lot of times we, unfortunately, in our churches, we get sort of caught up in being segregated into our own small group Sunday school classes. So, you've got the older people with their group, the middle-aged folks with their groups, the parents of young children in this group. Intergenerational ministry can really help teenagers. And so there's a challenge. I know the folks at Fuller would say the same thing, and I'm guessing you would agree.
Yeah. I'm glad you brought that up. So I think sometimes a youth group can be so off to the side as a youth group. And so we ask ourselves, why did teens leave the church? And sometimes they never were part of the church in the sense that they were in Sunday school with other kids. They were in youth group with other teens. And they go off to college, and they think, well, what is it I'm supposed to do here? And they go to a college ministry, maybe, and they don't know how to find the church because they never knew how to connect with adults in their home churches. So I think you're absolutely right that getting teens as they're 13, 14, 15, learning the normality of being a part of a church that is intergenerational and that the faith is not just a me and my peers thing, then they see themselves as part of something larger. And then when they get to college, it makes sense to find a church with multiple generations as well because they were doing it before they got there.
Boy, some really key issues, and in just a few minutes, we're going to unpack some of the other things that moms and dads need to know about as their kids head off to college. Our guest is Alex Chediak. He is a speaker and professor of engineering and physics at California Baptist University and the author of this brand new book, Preparing Your Teens for College. Now, I want to mention Alex's website as well. It's Alex Chediak. I'll spell that for you, chediak.com. One more time, Alex Chediak, chediak.com. You can learn more about Alex, his writing, his speaking, his work at Cal Baptist University. Maybe you'd like to have him come speak at your church somewhere in the upper Midwest to help your teenagers and your church thrive and grow and get equipped for that college experience. You're listening to the Faith Radio Network. It's 11:28. I'm Bill Meyer. We're going to take a quick break and be back with more with Alex Chediak after this message.
It's not just information, it's transformation.
I listen to
David Jeremiah in the morning, and I love his sermons. They just always seem to speak right to my heart, and I listen to Susie Larson in the afternoon, and she's always, like, talking right to me as well. You know, I tell my kids that it's garbage in, garbage out. What you listen to is what you think. And I get so blessed. Love your stations. Turn it on. Just listen. It's just going to uplift you.
Connecting faith to life every day. Thanks for listening to Faith Radio. Here's what's ahead on the next Connecting Faith.
Raising kids in a world pushing same-sex attraction is a challenge. But thankfully, wise advice and biblical counsel is available. Coming up on the next Connecting Faith, we'll talk about authentic masculinity and femininity in a gender-confused world with Glenn Stanton, Director for Family Formation Studies at Focus on the Family and author of Secure Daughters, Confident Sons. Important words for parents and families on the next Connecting Faith.
Listen for Connecting Faith weekdays at noon on Faith Radio.
The conversation continues right now, and we want to hear from you. Call us at 877-933-2484. That's 877-933-2484. Now, here's Dr. Bill Meyer again on Faith Radio.
And we do want to hear from you, whether you're listening to us here in the Twin Cities or perhaps in Madison or Fargo or Sioux Falls. Maybe you got us on in Waterloo or Duluth. Did I leave anybody else? I don't think so. We would love to hear from you, 877-93-FAITH. And give us your contact info. We'll enter you into a drawing for our a copy of one of these wonderful books, 10 Words of Life for an Addicted, Compulsive, Cynical, Divided, and Worn-Out Culture by our guest, Sean Gladding. Sean, in the story, which we mentioned before, this was a sermon series that you did when you were in Houston, but then you turned it into a story, which I love because I think story can teach us so much. It can reach the heart, both the heart and the mind. The pastor refers to the Ten Commandments as the 10 words. Why does he do that, and what difference does it make to the characters?
Yeah, most of us are very familiar with the Ten Commandments. You know, even in America, still, it's not a post-Christian culture like the United Kingdom is. And so even if people don't know what they are, they've still heard of the Ten Commandments. But interestingly enough, if you actually read the Hebrew Bible, only one time in the whole of Scripture are they referred to as the Ten Commandments. Everywhere else, they're referred to as the 10 words, which is where we get the word Decalogue from, another word for the Ten Commandments. And so even at the beginning of Exodus 20, it says, "And God spoke all these words to Moses." And so the reason they're not really commandments in the technical sense is that there is no punishment ascribed for breaking them. If you read the rest of the law, all the other commandments, if you break this commandment, this is what happens to you. But in the 10 words, there's none of that. And so I really wanted to emphasize that reality. And again, realizing that most of us still approach the 10 commandments as rules and not as words, or as I tend to talk about them, as practices that God gives us to adopt, rather than rules either to keep or not. And so I think thinking about them as rules has not really been helpful for us, especially in this stage of cultural movement in the United States. And so because if they're rules and they become something, I think when we talk about them as rules, what we usually mean is those are rules that those people over there ought to keep. And I think that's why we argue and fight to try and get them posted in public places like courthouses, to say, America, we sense it's going in the wrong direction morally. What we need is if we just posted the Ten Commandments in courthouses, then that would be a reminder of the rules by which our society should be governed. And, you know, while I think there is something to that, I think much more helpful and probably more faithful to the Scriptures is these are things that God has given to us, those who claim to follow Jesus, as practices to embody ourselves rather than rules to impose on other people. The idea being that if we actually lived according to what the Ten Commandments, the 10 words, call us to, I think that would be far more compelling than people seeing them carved into stone on a courthouse lawn. And that's always the challenge with Scripture. It's much easier to argue about what the Bible
does or doesn't say, or what this means or what it doesn't mean, rather than actually try to embody that in the way we live our life. And I think that our life is what is the most compelling witness to the gospel, and not our ability to talk about what the Bible says or what we think it says. And so I hope in terms of talking about them as the 10 words or 10 practices, especially in the context for which they are given, that's a helpful way into this really countercultural way of life that the Bible calls us to, and that Jesus embodied and then called us as his disciples to live.
Tell me about some of the characters in the book. Who are they, and what are their backgrounds, and how do they interact with this pastor?
Yeah, so the context is that this pastor, his day off is Mondays, and he's sitting in his favorite coffee shop early in the morning, and one of the characters in the coffee shop that everyone knows and loves starts berating the Christians because of what he sees in the headline of the newspaper that day, which ironically was the actual headline in my local newspaper, the Lexington Herald Leader, on the day I sat down to begin writing the book. And right on the front cover of the paper were these words, 10 commandments fight proves costly. And two counties in eastern Kentucky, the poorest part of our state, had fought for the right to post the 10 commandments in their courthouses all the way to the Supreme Court and lost. And the report said, you know, if you've been following this story, this is the end. And what it's meant is that these counties now owe the ACLU $500,000 in legal fees. And they admit that, frankly, they don't know where the money's going to come from. Mm. And so this character says, what do you think about that, Pastor? What do you think about, you know, you Christians doing stuff like that? So it's very provocative, you know, and questions that I've heard people have asked me. And then the pastor begins to respond, and as often happens, if you're in the kind of coffee shops at least that I hang out in, other people get involved, drawn into the conversation, share their own opinions. And so the conversation, you know, begins around that, and then that becomes sort of the focal point for a wider discussion about American culture in general and the sort of way we have a sense that we're losing our way. Whatever we think, we recognize that this is not the kind of world, the kind of country we thought we were living in, that there are all kinds of challenges, social challenges we're facing, and politicians don't seem to be helping us address them. And so that then leads into this pastor saying, you know what, this has been really stimulating, and I've been wondering about preaching a sermon series. Maybe I should preach a series on the Ten Commandments, and maybe you guys could help me prepare that each week. Would you be willing to come back every Monday and have a conversation? And so that's sort of how the setting for the book takes place. And so week by week, and that small group and then some other people are added to it, get together for an hour to discuss one of the Ten Commandments each week, which really modeled how I am approached the sermon series, which is I got together about 6 months before I planned to preach with a group on Wednesday nights, which was very diverse, and we looked at one of the commandments, we read some other scriptures around it, and then had a discussion. Where does this word intersect with your life? What do you think about this? What are the implications for this? And so some of the other characters that join the conversation are folk from the pastor's church, so they self-identify as Christians. And several of them are in recovery from addiction. And then there's a couple of high school students who join the conversation in, I think, the third week, to bring a more youthful perspective, perhaps. So it's a pretty diverse group, and that's the sort of the group that then has this conversation each week about one of the words.
Who's the character that first confronts the pastor? You said kind of a local character.
Yeah, his name is Steve, and I have known lots of Steves. And when you've been a pastor, if any of people listening up in pastoral or self, you know, where people know you as a church employee or a pastor, then if you're in a public setting, you become the expert on the faith, on Christianity, or even any religion sometimes, and people say, hey, what do you think about that pastor? You're a pastor, you should know. And so I've known several characters like that, and they're lovely, and I thoroughly enjoy people and have friends with folk who still would not consider themselves at all religious, but love talking about things that really matter in life.
I'm curious. So I'm curious. How did the pastor respond to this gentleman when he initially confronts him on the Ten Commandments in the courthouse issue. What was his response to this very confrontive gentleman?
Well, it, again, modeled on the way what I have learned over the years is to ask a question rather than get defensive. So he says, so why do you think people would be willing to spend $500,000 of taxpayers' money to fight for the right to post those, you know, on court? Can you imagine any reason why people might do that? And so other people begin to give answers to that question. And then says, I wonder if the reason people do that is because not of the headline on the front page, but all the headlines inside the newspaper. And so he invites Steve to open the paper and start reading the headlines out. And what do you find in the headlines in the local newspaper pretty much every day? You find talk of theft. You find talk of murder. You find talk of sex scandals of some kind, of politicians lying about other politics. Like, so all the content of the 10 words you can find in the other headlines. And so the pastor says, I wonder if that's why. You know, it's when people read the newspaper or watch the news or just pay attention to what's happening around them, they say, this isn't how we should treat each other. Mm-hmm. And maybe people just want something concrete to point to and say, that is how we ought to treat each other. For better or for worse, at least there's a succinct summary, right, of addressing the things that you and I know are challenges in our neighborhood and in our culture. Mm-hmm. And so that's how he begins to respond.
I love it. I love it. You're reminding me a lot of Tim Keller from Manhattan and his use of questions when he's talking to people who may be hostile to the gospel, maybe skeptics, agnostics. Tim typically uses that same line, and I love it. His book Reason for God or Reasons for God does that same sort of a thing. In the book 10, you chose to go through the Ten Commandments in the reverse order. And what was your rationale for that?
Again, I'm borrowing from other folk. My parents still live in England. And many, many years ago, they told me that they'd been a traveling evangelist who had come to our hometown, Norwich, and was doing a series on the Ten Commandments in a very public venue. And not a church, but it's in a public venue. And she's, you know, my parents are saying, you know, hundreds and hundreds of people are coming out every week, and it's not all church folk. And so I was intrigued. I said, well, tell me, why would in England, why would lots of people show up to hear? And she says, that's not just the way he's talking about them. He's very practical. And so I began to research this guy. His name is Jay John. And I read an interview with him, and he said, you know, in a post-Christian culture like the UK, if you want to talk about the Ten Commandments, if you start with the first one, that there is a God, you know, most people aren't going to come back the following week. But if you start with the Tenth Commandment, which is don't want what other people have, well, you know, our economy is based on that. Everyone relates to that. Everyone understands that. So they might come back the next week, and then it's about lying and, you know, not telling the truth and spin. Well, everybody experiences that. And so, you know, people, you hit these last few words, which if you preach them in the reverse order, hit people where they live. And he said, so for some people, if they keep coming back and not only hit them in terms of what other people do, but begin to identify all the ways that they have broken and don't keep these words, if they stick around and get to the first word, which is there is a God who has set you free from slavery, for some people that suddenly becomes good news. It just made total sense to me. And so when it came to preaching the series ourselves at Mercy Street, we did it in that order. And again, in writing the book, I wanted to do it in that order. So that who doesn't relate to the first few? And then as it gets to the more sort of obtuse, don't have idols, you know, don't bless, you know, don't take the name of the Lord your God in vain. Well, if you've been working through all these other things, these begin to, you might have a better sense of what these other words might mean.
Great perspective. I love it, Sean. We're talking to Sean Gladding. He is the author of the brand new book, 10 Words of Life for an Addicted, Compulsive, Cynical, Divided, and Worn Out Culture. And we have three copies of the book to give away if you'd like to call us at 877-93-FAITH. Give us your contact info. We'll have a drawing at the end of the hour. And if you have any questions for Sean, by all means, give us a call right now, and we'll pass those along to him. It's 11:45, and you are listening to the Faith Radio Network. I'm Bill Meyer. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back with more with Sean in just a bit.
In 2014, we're planting truth together on Faith Radio. Here's this week's Bible passage and word from Pastor Andy Stanley.
Do not conform any longer to the pattern of this world. Did you know your heritage is a pattern of the world? Just because your daddy did it, your great-granddaddy did it, that's just a pattern of the world. Paul says, you don't have to be the same as all of them. Look at the verse. But be transformed. How? By the renewing of your mind, so that you might be able to test and approve what God's will is, His good, pleasing, and perfect will. See, when you start playing those tapes and that old thing comes around, well, I can't help it, I can't change, you stop and you say, no. I am not going to be conformed any longer to the pattern of this world. I'm going to be transformed by the renewing of my mind so that I can test and approve what God's will is, His good, perfect, and perfect will for my life.
Planting truth and growing together this week on Faith Radio. See all the verses and commit them to memory at myfaithradio.com.
It's like my eyes were opened. I kind of knew what I wanted to study, but after discovering what Northwestern had to offer in that field, I finally saw the path.
At Northwestern's Major Discovery, Thursday, March 20th at 5 p.m., your student can learn more about specific majors and take a step closer to deciding what to study in college and where to study it. You can enjoy a nice dinner and visit with professors and students. To register, visit unwsp.edu/visit. University of Northwestern, St. Paul, your life on purpose.
Now, back to Dr. Bill Meyer live on Faith Radio.
And welcome back. Our guest, Sean Gladding, the author of the new book, 10. Michael Frost, the author of Exile, says, you've never heard the Ten Commandments taught quite like this. And it's true, as Sean has described, it's a pastor in a coffee shop talking to a group of people, and they're actually helping him prepare his sermon series on the Ten Commandments. And let's dive into a few of the commandments. One of the things that you say in the book, I guess the pastor would say it, or maybe it's one of the characters, envy equals desire plus resentment. And I'm wondering, how does that play out in the book? And on a more practical basis, what is the antidote for that in today's materialistic, narcissistic culture?
Again, a great question. That is actually a formula that my best friend and co-pastor at Mercy Street came up with during the series. It's this idea that envy is equal to desire plus resentment. It's not just that I want something, it's that I resent the fact that someone else has it, and that's a key component of envy. It's the old story of trying to keep up with the Joneses, right? It's not enough for me to have what I have. If my neighbor has something better, then I need to have it so I can keep up with them. So there's this resentment. So instead of finding delight that other people have certain things, we learn to resent them for having them and try and either get them ourselves or perhaps even tear down what they have. And so I think that in some ways, the cynical part of our culture, that our advertising is based on creating desire for things we didn't even know we knew, that we didn't know we needed until we're bombarded with messages that say things like, you deserve this, you need this, it's your right to have this, or that some of the language, especially you deserve, that's a very much the language of advertising in my experience. And so I think the antidote, one of the antidotes for envy or the sense of, I deserve this, whatever this is gratitude, is learning to be thankful for what we already have. A good friend of mine who's an old-timer in Alcoholics Anonymous often says, Sean, if you woke up tomorrow morning and the only possessions you had and the only relationships you had left were those that you had been grateful for today, what kind of a home would you wake up to? Yeah. And I think so often we're bombarded with messages that tell us what we lack, what we don't have, that we fail to be grateful for what we have. And so that what I think the word against envy invites us into is a life of contentment, to be satisfied with what we already have. And once we begin to learn that, I think it begins to change fundamentally how we approach possessions and how we approach our neighbors. So instead of being jealous for my friend who just got a brand new Harley Davidson and I'm still riding the same one I've been riding for 22 years, I can celebrate for him and not feel like, well, I need to get one. Why don't I have that? Why hasn't my life worked out? I thought, you know what? I have a Harley Davidson. And yes, it's 30-something years old, but it still runs. It's a great bike. And I need that reminder. And so I think contentment and gratitude is the antidote to envy and desire plus resentment.
Mm. You know, we're trying in our home to work on that very issue with our children. I have three kids who are 11, 9, and 7, and wonderful children, but there is a lot of envy going on. He got this, she got this, and right now it's over kind of silly things, one of which is playdates. Well, he got more playdates with his friends than I got, and we're trying to help them to learn to be content. And to learn, as you said, to celebrate when their sibling, you know, gets something positive, wonderful, time with a friend is something that, you know, you should celebrate for him instead of saying, I didn't get as many. And it is a real challenge. And I was talking to my wife the other day, and I said, this is just driving me crazy, this envy between these three kids who have so much, so many blessings. And I try to remind them, you know, we sponsor two kids through Compassion, and I try to remind them, well, you know, Jose in down there in Peru, he ain't going to be going out for frozen yogurt. I mean, he and yet,
right.
I so I'm kind of going up against this brick wall with them, and my wife brought me back to earth and said, hun, it's the sin nature. And I went, well, yeah, I guess that's true. Hopefully we'll outgrow it.
It's also developmental, right, at that age.
Yes.
But it's just part of it. And so all we can do is keep enforcing. You know, and I have a 10 and an 8-year-old, so this is not something I'm unfamiliar with. But we just keep reminding them, well, what was good? What was good? What do you have? And hopefully in that just constant repetition, some of that will slowly sink in. But clearly, most of us continue to still struggle with that. So it's a lifelong challenge. But again, it's one that because we forget, we need to be reminded. And so that's why I think God tells Moses, and Moses says, you know, write these on your heart, write them on your forehead, you know, get them into your kids. When you're walking on the road, talk about them, like, because we're so quick to forget these very basic things about what it means to live in community with others where we want the best for each other. So we create the kind of society where everyone can flourish, not just a few.
Mm. Another issue you tackle in the book, one of the commandments, which, of course, this is so significant given our sex-saturated culture, is thou shalt not commit adultery. And we have so many in our society who see a commandment, a rule like that, as being unrealistic and incredibly restrictive and narrow-minded. Can you explain, and how your character explains in the book, how it actually brings freedom to our lives?
Yeah, again, this is one perspective, but I think there's a great deal of truth in this, in that it's not, you know, the problem is not that our culture thinks about sex and talks about sex so much. I think the problem is that our culture talks about sex so poorly. And it just reflects our ongoing, highly individualistic culture, which sex is about my self-satisfaction, my need to be fulfilled, and it's very much an emphasis on my rights to have the kind of sex life I think I ought to have. And I think that, again, runs completely counter to the revelation of God and humanity in the scriptures, which is, no, it's not about you and your personal satisfaction. It really is about being part of a people who are seeking the welfare of everybody. And so how do you learn in every area of your life to be self-giving, not self-satisfying? And so I think it's no different in the area of sex than any other area, including the one you just talked about, material possessions. How do I, you know, learn to not try to satisfy all of my desires, but how do I want, you know, for people to have what they need to have? And so when it comes to sexuality, I think, yes, you can say, do not commit adultery. Well, what if, you know, what if my spouse can't meet my needs? You know, well, that's one thing to recognize is that's legitimate. You know, all of us have legitimate needs, and one of those is sexuality, you know, a legitimate need to have a sexual expression that is healthy and life-giving and meaningful. And what do you do if your spouse doesn't meet the need that you have? I'm not sure the best answer is to go find someone else, because often it's not only the, you know, the issue isn't often the only, the other person in the equation. There's often something inside ourselves that's part of that. Also, I think our culture has entirely unrealistic expectations about what sexual satisfaction is. And so, again, returning to the very core, the very beginning of our story, this beautiful description of the first human couple who were naked and unashamed, that I think very, very few of us in this culture ever feel unashamed when we're naked, whether that's naked physically or naked emotionally or naked spiritually. We feel a lot of shame around that. And so how do you learn to become unashamed about your sexuality? How do you learn to become unashamed about your physicality? It's by having a safe place to get naked with someone else. And I truly believe the safest place in the world for the sexual relationship and the safest place in the world to make yourself vulnerable with another human being is in a covenanted relationship where you have made commitments and promises to each other, for better or for worse, in every area of our life. I'm not going anywhere. And so if our sex life is not what we might want, we're not going to go anywhere. We're going to say, how can we figure this out? How do we get help with this? And that is the work of years. And sometimes the church has told the equal and opposite untruth, which is, if you just save yourself from marriage, then your sex life will be great. I think that's not true, as anyone who has done that has probably realized. You know, marriage is hard work. You know, beautiful shared sexuality is hard work. None of this is easy. But the key is to have a safe container within which to work that out. And I really believe covenanted relationships are the safest place for that to happen. And so what we find is that if you go looking for that somewhere else, you may find it briefly, as many people do. But then if you break up one marriage and move into the other one, then all the things that you brought to your own first marriage that you know, were part of the problem, you bring right into the second one. And so the challenge, and we do the same with the church, right? We, you know, well, my needs aren't being met in this church, so I'm going to go find another church.
Exactly.
We do the same thing rather than say, what do I have to bring to this? Sean, go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. We're just about out of time for the hour. And
okay.
I'm sorry we've only had a chance to unpack a few of the commandments, but I want to encourage our listeners to get this book, Sean Gladding's 10, and you will find the 10 commandments will come alive in a brand new way. Thank you for your time today, Sean, your commitment to biblical truth, and we appreciate you so much.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me on your show, Bill.